Thank you. Be seated. The court is ready to hear argument in bar, arguments from petitioner in bar versus Resolution Trust Corporation.
May it please the court, Mr. Al Greco will present argument for petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Al Greco and I'm here on behalf of petitioner George Barr in this matter. The issue before the court on petitioner's writ of error is the doctrine of res judicata. The doctrine of res judicata dates back to the common law and has been recognized by the courts of our state for almost a century. I've outlined the most recent Texas Supreme Court cases which have dealt with res judicata in my application for writ of error. In each of these cases, this court has recognized a distinction between res judicata and collateral estoppel. This court has held, as have other courts across the state, the courts of appeals, and our federal courts, that res judicata is a more broad doctrine than collateral estoppel. The key to each of these doctrines is to review the pleadings that were filed in both the first and the second lawsuits. The facts of this matter are that Sunbelt Savings Association obtained a promissory note from a partnership by the name of Bar 3. Now, the similarity in name to my client is not because Mr. Barr was the general partner in the partnership. The evidence on this case shows that Mr. Barr was, at least the summary judgment evidence presented by him, a limited partner to the extent of $72,000 in this partnership. The Bar 3 note was secured by three guarantees. When the note came due, Sunbelt filed three separate actions, one against Mr. Barr in the 14th District Court, one against Mr. Knott and the partnership, which was the 101st District Court, which is the case we're here on appeal today, and a third suit against Mr. Franz Werkmer, who was the third partner in the Bar 3 venture. All suits were filed simultaneously. They had consecutive cause numbers. In the first lawsuit against Mr. Barr, which I refer to in my application, I refer to here today as the first suit, the respondent has argued on appeal that it was just a suit on the guarantee. Our contention is that this assertion is incorrect. When we look to the pleadings, and the pleadings in the from the 14th District Court were made a part of the record in the trial court herein and are part of the transcript. Certified copies were filed with the 101st District Court, and they're also on appeal. The references to the original pleadings in the 14th, where they can be found in the transcript, are found in my application for writ of error. But the original plaintiff's petition against Mr. Barr in the first lawsuit stated in the last paragraph, immediately before the prayer, by reason of the default under the promissory note, plaintiff has been required to employ the undersigned attorneys to represent it to file suit in order to collect the balance due on the promissory note. Now, this is a direct quote from the first lawsuit, which they allege related only to the guarantee agreement. Subsequent to the filing of the plaintiff's original petition, Mr. Barr filed special exceptions complaining that the amount they sought to collect was not clear, that there was no designation of what he was being sued on. In response to the special exceptions that were filed, the plaintiff filed its first amended original petition, to which it attached a copy of the promissory note, which is the same note that was sued on in the case we're here on today. It alleged with specificity all of the circumstances surrounding the execution of the note, the default by Bar 3 Venture of that note, the amount which was due on that note. These are all found on page 3 of their First Amended Original Petition. They also stated in their application or in their request for relief from the court that Defendant Barr is personally liable for all sums due and owing under the second note. Now, the second note is the note that's in issue in the suit that we're here on today. It is clear that the issue of the promissory note was before the 14th Judicial District Court in the first lawsuit. They put this in their pleadings. They've made these statements I've just recited to the court, all relative to the note. In fact, if they could not have proved the existence and the default under the note, there could have been nothing to request from the court against Mr. Barr. Clearly, the application to the court for relief was to recover the sums due and owing under that promissory note. They filed a motion for summary judgment in the 14th Judicial District Court in which they put under their title undisputed facts. They proved up, again, the existence of the promissory note, the default, the amount owing, and they stated, and this is another direct quote, as a part of the same transaction as the execution of the promissory note, Mr. Barr executed the purported guarantee. They attached all of this evidence to the affidavit of Leslie Hubbard, who in his sworn testimony again recited that as a part of the same transaction, the note and the guarantee were executed. It's interesting that Mr. Hubbard's affidavit that was attached to the motion for summary judgment in the 14th Judicial District Court is the same affidavit that was filed and attached to their motion for summary judgment in this case.
What about Sunbelt's argument that you're making inconsistent, you're taking an inconsistent position here at the trial court?
I don't believe we are, Your Honor.
In the trial court, you were arguing that the disputed guarantee instrument did not specify the nature of the note he was guaranteeing, and they were not related.
I believe that's a mischaracterization of our argument. In the 14th Judicial District Court, we asserted that the guarantee agreement could not support a judgment in favor of Sunbelt. We put forth our motion for summary judgment that there was not, as a movement, a defendant moving for summary judgment, we necessarily had to negate at least one essential element of the plaintiff's cause of action. And effectively, we did that by asserting that they could not recover based on the pleadings they had before the court and the evidence that was before the court, and that is what the court granted its judgment on. The respondent urges that we should make a very narrow and limited reading of the judgment in the 14th District Court. What I believe is required is that we look to the judgment on its face and see what exactly the judgment states. The order granting summary judgment dated February 23, 1989 stated, "It is therefore ordered, adjudged, and decreed that defendant's motion for summary judgment be and hereby is in all things granted, and that the plaintiff take nothing in its suit against George J. Barr." Now, the judgment, the order on summary judgment did not state, as the respondent suggests, the guarantee is unenforceable and therefore incomplete and could not substantiate a judgment. It stated that the plaintiff take nothing against Mr. Barr. When we then look to the actual judgment of the 14th, there were some third-party claims that Mr. Barr had advanced against the other partners, which after the summary judgment in his favor, he non-suited. Subsequent to the non-suit, the court entered its judgment, which stated in pertinent part, the court granted summary judgment against plaintiff on each of the claims presented in its suit. The judgment goes on to further state, all other matters having been disposed of, it is therefore ordered, adjudged, and decreed that the February 23, 1989 order granting summary judgment in favor of defendant George J. Barr and against Sunbelt Saves Association FSB Dallas is hereby final. The court further states, it is further ordered, adjudged, and decreed that plaintiff Sunbelt Savings FSB Dallas, Texas have and recover nothing from defendant George J. Barr. Now, there was no appeal from this judgment that was ever taken. There were no findings of fact required or requested of the court as to what exactly the court found in rendering that judgment.
There are no findings of fact in summary judgment.
I understand that, Your Honor. There was nothing other than the final judgment of the court, which says it is a take-nothing judgment. They haven't recovered nothing on their claims. In their original petition, they advanced all of the proof necessary, all the proof that was required to prove up the indebtedness which they seek to hold Mr. Barr responsible for today. And it is our position that having put all of those matters at issue with the pleadings, they are now unable to come back and file a second lawsuit alleging the same proof, the same facts, and attempting to hold them liable under a separate legal theory. In all of the cases that discuss the application of the doctrine of res judicata, one of the elements that the court has listed is diligence. It matters with the use of diligence could have been included but were not included in the prior suit. It appears from the pleadings on the prior suit and based upon the evidence that was before the court in the prior suit that all that would have been required in order to substantiate a claim on the note itself in the first suit was one simple sentence stating that they were requesting relief under the promissory note as well. All the proof proving up the promissory note was a necessary element to a judgment on the guarantee. All of that proof was before the court on their motion for summary judgment and attached to their pleadings. It is one sentence that could have been added to their pleading, which would have made the first lawsuit in the 14th the equivalent of what they've done herein with respect to Mr. Knott. Mr. Knott shared more or less the same position as Mr. Barr. He signed a guarantee that was identical to Mr. Barr's guarantee. Mr. Knott also was the individual who signed the partnership note. They sued Mr. Knott in this suit on both his guarantee and as an obligor under the partnership note. This is precisely what they could have done with respect to Mr. Barr and precisely what they should have done against Mr. Barr in the first suit in order to afford judicial economy and not have to bring him into a second lawsuit. It was their failure to include one claim, a different legal theory, which amounts to the want of diligence. The same issues were involved in both suits. The same facts were involved in both suits. They like to urge now that there was a different transaction or that it was not part of the same fact scenario which gave rise to the liability under the guarantee. As we pointed out, the evidence which they put before the court, the allegations they put before the court, incorporated all of the same facts and all of the same evidence. In fact, they would have been unable to prove up liability under the guarantee without proving the existence of the note and the default. Otherwise, there would have been nothing to render a judgment on. They cited this court's decision in Universal Metals versus Bohart for the proposition that the same proof which proves up the obligation under the promissory note proves up the liability under the guarantee. This court has already determined that the factual evidence necessary is the same in both causes of action. They've cited this court's statement for the same proposition, but now they come here today saying that for some reason it's different and the two causes of action are mutually independent. The petitioner asserts that they're not mutually independent, that all the same facts and the same evidence were before the court in the first lawsuit, and that their failure to properly include a cause of action on the note was nothing more than a want of diligence, a choice, a conscious choice made by them. They did it here with Mr. Knott. They could have done it there with Mr. Barr. And that because they failed to do this and Mr. Barr was granted a judgment in his favor, a take-nothing judgment on their claims, they cannot relitigate those same issues, those same facts, in a second suit against Mr. Barr.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May I please the court to
why did you find it necessary to file three different lawsuits for essentially the same claim that you could have brought in one lawsuit? Was it because perhaps you could not bill your client for three lawsuits? You can bill your client for three lawsuits more than one?
No, Your Honor, that was not the reason. In fact, Sunbelt Saving Association of Texas filed the three lawsuits. I represented at the time Sunbelt Savings FSB, Dallas, Texas, which was a federally created institution which received the assets of Sunbelt Savings Association of Texas.
So you did not make the decision, somebody else did.
That's correct, Your Honor. That was a prior was a law firm handling the prior client, the prior entity. The reason for that being done, though, however, is that strategically, guarantees and notes are different. They are different legal obligations. This court has identified them as such in numerous cases. They have different defenses available to them. At the time, the in vogue thing to do was to have a partnership note go into bankruptcy, thereby staying all actions against the individual partners and the guarantors. until such time as severances could occur, and that would cause exactly more litigation because you have to follow the severance, get the causes severed, have then three actions, and then proceed. So what was strategically and tactically being done was filing against the guarantor for several reasons. One, the guarantor allowed generally fewer defenses that would have to be litigated, which would reduce the cost to all the parties. Two, like I said, the problem with the bankruptcy situations, which were, as the court records reflect and as the Georgia court takes judicial notice of, were happening in mass numbers during this time on partnership debt, where there was a single asset securing the debt, or a single piece of real property which underlied the obligation.
You didn't find that a problem, however, because you did sue to collect on the note and on the guarantee agreement as to some of the parties, except not all of them.
The only person that we were familiar with at the time under that partnership was Mr. Knott. He had actually been the party signed the note, and we sued him as a guarantor initially.
And also on the note.
Also on the note, because he executed the note on behalf of the partnership, so that was clear that he was a party to that partnership. But at the time, we were getting indications and sworn statements and affidavits from Mr. Barr that he was a limited partner and therefore would not be liable on the note. The record will reflect that in
a different partnership guarantor agreements, or is there one agreement signed by three parties?
There were three separate guarantees. Each one was a separate document signed separately, so it didn't connect anybody. In fact, two different lawyers in my firm were working on the cases because we did not know that there was a connection. As the record would reflect, Chuck Keeble handled the case against Mr. Barr. It wasn't until I sent out an interrogatory to Barr Three Ventures that they identified Mr. Barr as a general partner. They then came back in the beginning of April, so they subsequently amended our suit several days later to include Mr. Barr as a general partner. Your Honor, in this appeal, I represent the Resolution Trust Corporation as receiver for Sunbelt Federal Savings. In its capacity as receiver from Sunbelt Federal Savings. Sunbelt Federal Savings and the receiver are in this appeal as both a petitioner and a respondent. Contrary to Mr. Barr's contention, this case is not barred by the doctrine of res judicata. The doctrine does not apply to the facts of this case. Rather, Sunbelt is entitled to a judgment against Mr. Barr for the full amount of the Barr 3 venture note obligation. The two issues before the court are simply these. First, does a suit against an individual on a guarantee agreement, which is found solely to be incomplete and therefore unenforceable, bar a subsequent suit against that same individual in his capacity as a general partner of the maker of the note? We submit to the court the answer to that question is yes. Second issue is, based upon the summary judgment evidence before the trial court, was it proper for the trial court to deny summary judgment? We believe that summary judgment should have been granted for Sunbelt at the time, and that the trial court's action was improper. I'll first address the issue of res judicata. Res judicata is a good rule. When properly applied, the rule fulfills its purposes and obligations without causing injustice. Improperly applied, however, the effects of res judicata bar can be inequitable and unfair. As stated by Professor Cleary in his Law Review article, res judicata reexamined, giving it a prior decision effect beyond its actual scope is just as undesirable as according to an insufficient effect. The doctrine of res judicata is often expressed in this court's opinions as a judgment in a prior suit will preclude a second suit by the parties and their privies, not only as the matter is actually litigated and defenses, but also to causes of action and defenses which arise out of the same subject matter which might have been litigated in the first suit. But like any broad-based rule, the application of the doctrine to a specific set of facts sometimes proves more difficult than anticipated. This has been especially true for the application of the doctrine of res judicata, with its draconian penalty of an absolute bar to further litigation.
Certainly, if you took just that expression of the rule and applied it to this case, it would look as if the second action were barred, would it not?
Yes, sir, it would. It's applying that standard to this case. As the case law indicates, that standard is not ever really applied. That's just a rule that is set forth, which is seldom ever applied per its terms. Or at least those terms are significantly narrowed in its application, which I assert should occur in this case. The case law evidences this court's struggle, as well as the appellate court's struggle, with the application of the doctrine and the efforts to articulate a single rule applicable to all situations. It is these efforts which demonstrate that one rule cannot be uniformly applied to all situations. The application of a res judicata rule for tort action cannot mirror the application of a res judicata rule for contract disputes. The inherent differences between these two causes of action demand a rule tailored to the circumstances. As stated again by Professor Cleary in his Law Review article, deciding issues by definition is easy and therefore a method which courts are prone to follow. But the easy way is not necessarily the best way. A careful examination of the definition and purposes which underlie the rule of res judicata is necessary for its proper application. In Gilbert versus Fireside Enterprises, the Dallas Court of Appeals, after reviewing several Supreme Court cases, went to great lengths to identify the policy considerations which underlie the rule of res judicata. In Westinghouse Credit Corporation versus Townslar, this court intimated that these policy considerations must be substantially offended by the maintenance of a subsequent action before the conclusion of the action is warranted by the harsh doctrine of res judicata. This court again indicated its preference to narrowly apply the doctrine of res judicata in Coalition of Cities versus PUC. Applying each of these policy considerations to the case at bar, the court will disclose the inapplicability of this doctrine to this case. The first policy consideration is that of judicial economy. Judicial economy was not wasted by the guarantee suit, since it was promptly terminated by summary judgment. No court time was spent on the issue of Mr. Barr's partnership liability or the issue concerning the default of the promissory notes.
But that just is as it happens. Surely the res judicata can't depend on its application on whether it happens to be terminated without too much trouble or whether it takes a lot of time. If that had been a knockdown, drag-out fight, the application of res judicata ought to be the same.
Your Honor, I agree. Had it been a knockdown, drag-out fight, and liability and a note was asserted, no summary judgment would have been granted.
If it had just been a knockdown, drag-out fight on the guarantee, the fact that it was an extensive litigation ought not to determine whether res judicata applies.
No, but I'm saying from the policy consideration of judicial economy was not lost in this case. The note action was being pursued at the same time, in fact. So the courts were in the process of litigating the note issue. It was just being done in a different court.
I get the distinct impression, and perhaps it's wrong, but help me with this. I get the distinct impression that somebody made a decision to file three different lawsuits basically in the same transaction so you could have the meter running in three cases. It's better to have the meter running in three cases as opposed to one. And if you had used diligence, you could have brought all of these claims, a suit on the note and against the guarantors in one suit.
Your Honor, I think let me try and respond to your question. It was not an effort to get the meter running to increase legal fees. In fact, the final three suits under these circumstances was an effort to reduce legal fees and to expedite resolution of these matters. Because, like I indicated, guarantee lawsuits have a lot less expenses available to them than note lawsuits. Usury can't be asserted. A lot of personal defenses cannot be asserted in a guarantee suit. That's the pronouncements of this court. So we have less defenses that would have to be litigated under a guarantee lawsuit.
You didn't find that to be a problem with at least with some of the parties? You did file...
No, just to one of the parties who actually accepted the note.
So you didn't see these problems that you're talking about, failure to assert defenses as to one of the parties, so why are you asserting them now?
At that, pursuing him on his guarantee, we were pursuing him on his guarantee, Mr.
And on the note.
And on the note. We were actually pursuing the partnership on the note, Your Honor, and him on his guarantee. The partnership was included in that lawsuit.
The same lawsuit?
Yes, in the same lawsuit. But it would have, if we get summary judgment on the guarantees, that would reduce the litigation. Had we been involved and brought them all in in one part, in one action, we'd have to possibly deal with varying defenses, which would have dragged all the parties through all the defenses and would have had the same amount of litigation occurred and more cost likely to have occurred in that procedure. When you multiply lawsuits by numerous defendants, you create situations where defendant A has to sit through a deposition of defendant B if that is to occur, where defendant B may not have any relationship to that defense. I may not care about that defense. Yet he's incurring the cost of having to go through that whole exercise. We're hoping to avoid a lot of those costs by doing it this method.
I take it there's nothing in the record that suggests that these lawsuits were filed for any improper motive.
No, sir.
And certainly I would think there's nothing in the record to suggest that these three lawsuits were filed to get the meter running in three cases.
Absolutely not.
But what is there in the record to suggest that there was some other tactical motive? Is any of that in there?
The simple fact, Your Honor, that the only issue that was placed before the 14th District Court against Mr. Barr was his liability guarantee, not the note. That issue was not raised. In fact, we set forth as undisputed facts the note obligation. Those were not contested. There was never a contest as to that the note was signed, that the note was outstanding, that an amount of some certain was due and owing. Those were not contested issues.
It seems like that your argument in this case is about res judicata is case specific, that your argument is directed to what happened in this case as opposed to what might happen in the same legal setting, but a different factual setting and another set of cases. But what my question to you is, can res judicata depend on that? In other words, can we apply in one case because it did not amount to a loss of judicial economy and apply it differently in another case because, as it turned out, it did?
You know, I don't think judicial economy is the fundamental factor that should be considered for res judicata purposes. That theory and that rationale for applying res judicata has been severely criticized by most of the writers on the topic. Generally, they say the courts are here to try lawsuits, and they shouldn't dismiss the lawsuits for the purposes because it doesn't fit with judicial, with the court's time schedule. So that, I don't think that the judicial economy is the pinnacle or the apex of the argument that should be advanced. However, to respond to your question, what we're trying to deal with here is issues that were not litigated in the first lawsuit. Okay, it's that gray area of res judicata, not what was actually litigated in the first lawsuit.
That's not the issue. Could they have been litigated in the first lawsuit with you if you had used diligence? Isn't that the question?
Well, to the extent that is the question, Your Honor, diligence was used because we were suing on the note in another lawsuit. It's not like Sunbelt sat back, tried one lawsuit, failed, and then initiated a new lawsuit. These three suits were established simultaneously. The lawsuit, the note obligation, was being pursued, but it was being pursued as a separate legal document. The idea is we need to put a ring around what is included in the cause of action. And in contract cases, what is included in the cause of action should be defined by the particular contract which is sued upon. In a closing of a large real estate transaction, for example, there may be 50 different contracts which are executed. Security agreements, deeds of trust, guarantees, pledges, all types of documents. What the court would be saying is, since that all happened in one closing, if they would adopt Mr. Barr's analysis and rule that way, they'd say that all breaches of any of those contracts had to be brought in one action. Now that's going to increase litigation, not reduce it. That's not going to serve the purposes of res judicata. It's not going to serve the purposes of this court to prevent inconsistent judgment, because a ruling on a res judicata bar in this case would actually create an inconsistent judgment situation.
And I take it that's because a client who would ordinarily just take his best shot first and give up on everything else that he won would be forced to on everything.
That's exactly right. And so you'd have multiple claims, multiplicity of claims being asserted that the client really didn't even want to pursue and spend the time and effort pursuing them. The fact is the judgment was rendered against Mr. Barr, or against the Barr 3 Venture. We have a judgment against the partnership. That would be inconsistent now to let one of the partners escape that liability because he got a summary judgment on a sole issue, that being that the guarantee did not guarantee this debt. And then this debt, then, he comes back and suggests to the court that this debt, yes, was in fact guaranteed, and these were all part of the same transaction. Well, they weren't part of the same transaction. They're different legal obligations. A guarantee is not a note, despite the San Antonio court's opinion that a guarantor and a partner are one and the same. They are not. They have different legal liabilities. They have different defenses available to them. This court, the courts work on legal distinctions. Do not try and merge those legal distinctions, but try to separate and identify those legal distinctions. And there are legal distinctions to be identified and separated in this case. Texas litigation is not the situation applied in this case, which is one of the second policy considerations. I'm going to repeat one other thing on the judicial economy. The motion by Mr. Barr completely sidestepped all issues concerning the note. Those were never actually litigated. It should not now pose a bar against Sunbelt on issues that were never actually litigated and were not part of the same cause of action. The two separate documents created two separate causes of action. The distinction between tort and contract cannot be overemphasized. Tort liability, you have one wrong. The idea behind res judicata, as I've come to learn from reading all these cases, is you're trying to have a movement advance his claims and cause of action as a result of a single wrong. If you have an individual who walks across the street and gets hit by a car, the law allows a multitude of claims to be asserted. The law says, oh, he could have filed the first suit for failure to look out, failure to maintain proper speed, failure to yield the right of way. You can have all these claims filed sequentially and create vexatious litigation and multiplicity of suits. But the law says, no, that one wrong needs to have one time the suit be brought and all issues be resolved. In a contract claim, the one wrong was the breach of the guarantee, not the breach of the guarantee and the note. Those are separate causes of action. We need to define what is the wrong. Don't look at the result as to what the damages are. Yep. That's result-oriented.
But don't you have to prove up a note in a suit to hold somebody liable on the guarantee agreement? I mean, you can't have one without the other. How can you have a suit on a guarantee agreement without ever proving up a note?
That's true. You have to prove up an obligation. You have to prove up a debt is owing. Now, whether that's by note or otherwise, you have to prove the debt is owing. However, those issues were, in this case, never considered by the court because those issues were all jumped over when the court considered the issue of the guarantee, which was the only issue before the court, which was the only ground of relief sought, was under the guarantee. If a note claim was sought, which it wasn't under that, there would have been no summary judgment because those issues were undisputed. Those were never disputed. In the summary judgment motion of Sunbelt, those were put down as undisputed facts, and they were not disputed. The only thing that was created was saying, this guarantee, which is the only document Sunbelt sues upon, does not guarantee this debt. And then they come back in the second action and say, oh, by the way, that guarantee, yeah, it did guarantee that debt. It was all the same. It was all part of the same thing. And therefore, we should be able to utilize that ruling for res judicata purposes. And Your Honor, we assert that that is an unjust, unethical use of the doctrine of res judicata. It is improper for them to make that kind of assertion after the previous assertions they made in the prior case, and that it is an expansion of the doctrine of res judicata, which is contrary to the narrow application of the doctrine which should be advanced by this court since the doctrine is so penal in nature. Some don't have multiple causes of action, and there is no, and as this court has remarked in the Griffin case, there is no mandatory joinder of claims. We are not required to join all claims an individual has against another individual in one cause of action. This court has specifically indicated that in various opinions, but that is not required for the reasons I believe I have stated earlier. There is no damage. The third policy consideration is double recovery. In light of the fact that Sunbelt was not successful in that action, that danger does not exist in this case as well. The question becomes, has the matter been once litigated? And the matter has not been litigated. There were two separate legal contractual obligations.
Any questions? Thank you, Joe.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Joe.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Your
understanding the arguments brought by the respondent today, they have conceded that the issues of the note were involved in the first lawsuit. Mr. Ross's own statement that had there been an allegation of liability on the note, there would not have been a summary judgment is proof positive of my assertion that had they used diligence, all of these matters could have been resolved in the first lawsuit.
I know you say earlier that you did not take the position in the first lawsuit that the guarantee was unrelated to the note, but if you had taken that position, would race judicata apply in this case?
I believe the doctrine of race judicata could still be applied, notwithstanding that position, for the reason that once they put these issues into their complaint, into their First Amended original petition, they tendered those issues to the court for determination. The cases that this court has dealt with, in some of those cases, the issues were not reached. For instance, in the Crow case, this court specifically stated that whether or not the allegations were made by Crow's predecessors and interests are irrelevant, and it's not in the record, but the court is going to hold that it's res judicata and bars those. In this instance, we asserted that the guarantee on its face was not an enforceable contract. If we had asserted that it didn't relate to the promissory note, the evidence before the court, which was placed there by Sunbelt, stated that, yes, it is related to this note. That is exactly what they did in response to our special exceptions.
But they essentially lost them, or they've lost something.
That's true, Your Honor, they did. And it follows with the statement that you made to Mr. Ross on his response here, that the multiplicity of allegations from the multiple contracts would cause a plaintiff to have to throw all of his allegations when he might otherwise take his best shot and then not go further. Well, that's exactly what they did here. They took their best shot. It didn't work. Now they've decided, instead of not going further, as you suggested they might do, go file a second lawsuit and try and attempt to hold Mr. Barr liable under a different legal theory. Everything that was stated by the respondent in argument and what's put forth in the brief and what we've asserted in our application is that they made a conscious choice to file three separate lawsuits. They've argued that there are defenses that would have been available on the note that weren't available on the guarantee. We thought the guarantee suit was going to be an easier suit to win. Everything he stated promotes their conscious decision to go forward in one lawsuit against Mr. Barr on those pleadings. Because they made a conscious decision, because they've admitted that with the use of diligence, by adding one sentence to that pleading, they could have avoided the summary judgment which they now seek to ask this court to not hold in my client's favor and bar their recovery, that equates to want of diligence. It was their action, their conscious decision, which has caused any inequitable result that may have occurred here.
Do you disagree with Mr. Ross's contention that ordinarily a guarantee suit would be a much surer, quicker, more cost-effective shot for them to take than a suit on a note?
That only fosters the same principle, that if they made that decision for their own reasons, to try and cut down on costs, to try and narrow the issues, whatever the reason was, they made that choice.
I understand your position. I want to know if you disagree with him or you agree with him that that is ordinarily a much more cost-efficient shot for a lender to take on a guarantee as opposed to suing on a note.
My personal opinion is that it is not that, and I have represented banking institutions in the past. I consider the one lawsuit to be the most effective means by suing everybody at the same time.
As long as you're talking about an equitable result, how about an inequitable result of your client guaranteeing a note and then walking away from it and said, you did it wrong, I don't have to pay? Isn't that inequitable?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe that is an inequity of my client. As the fact of this case would show, the first time the lawsuit was filed, it was dismissed without prosecution. They then reinstated the lawsuit. We prosecuted that suit. He defended it successfully. Now he's had to fight another lawsuit. He may have avoided liability on the $72,000, which he
guaranteed.
Excuse me?
Which he guaranteed.
Which he guaranteed. However, the resulting damage in having to defend against three lawsuits, I think, offsets that to some degree.
So rather than pay the note, he paid the lawyer.